This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckaberry. Thanks so much for listening. President Obama announced on Tuesday a decision that perfectly underscores, I think, the complexity and hard-to-evaluate Obama years in relation to the U.S. uniformed services. Obama will commute nearly all of Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning's sentence for treason, as well as 208 others. The president also pardoned 64 people, including retired General James Cartwright. The Manning decision, though, sends a message of sympathy for what Manning had been through without technically reversing the sentence. More on that story, plus one person who is still holding out hope for a pardon in just a minute. But the announcement reflects the deep complexity of President Obama's relationship with the military while in office. His pullback in troop deployments and drawdowns on the battlefield was matched by vast increases in electronic surveillance, use of drones, and special ops forces, often operating directly out of the White House. While trying to scale back the military aggression of his predecessor, the president ambitiously targeted whistleblowers like Manning in the name of national security.
I think that when President Obama came into office in 2008, many of his supporters thought that he would roll back the Bush administration's open-ended war on terror. But I think that what ended up happening in a lot of ways, despite early rhetoric to the contrary, is that both the legal doctrines and many of the activities of the Bush administration got extended rather than rolled back. And now we are very much in the era of perpetual conflict.
Rosa Brooks is a former Defense Department official and currently a law professor at Georgetown University. She's also the author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Obama ended combat, but in a sense, further enshrined a permanent state of war.
I think he fell prey to two different things. One was just the power of bureaucracy that under the Bush administration, the executive branch, the national security bureaucracy had essentially been retooled to focus on a kind of perpetually expanding conflict against always morphing terrorist groups. And that bureaucracy was pretty powerful. It's hard to roll it back when everybody's habits and paychecks depend on this particular understanding of the world. The other thing that happened, I think, was that he fell victim to a national security version of the Willie Horton effect. Remember Willie Horton and Michael Dukakis. You know, nobody wants to be the guy who fails to take action and then something really awful happens. He was able to end the large-scale U.S. combat involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that was what his constituency had really cared about. But when push came to shove, it's always going to be easier for any president to say yes rather than no when the question is, we have the opportunity to kill this really, really, really bad guy who might do something really, really, really bad in the future. Do you want us to go for it? Nobody wants to be the president who says, nah, I don't think he's a big deal. And then, you know, 20 people are killed with a suicide bomb and it's your fault.
One of the head scratchers of the Obama administration and the legacy here on these military matters is this commitment to being incremental. It seems as though Barack Obama, for whatever reason, decided that he was going to be plausibly presidential in every phase of policy, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East, the pivot to China, but not really make any radical changes. I'm just wondering, if you were to reimagine the military in terms of exactly what we need, how much smaller would it be? What kind of savings do you think we could get?
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of size. I think it's a matter of which capabilities we're focusing on. I think that we get kind of hung up on these kind of arbitrary questions about, well, should the end strength of the Army be 500,000 people or 400,000 or 600,000? The bigger question is I think the fact that in some ways we continue to have a 19th century military. It's not even a 20th century military, it's 19th century military, in that we still act as though the primary recruiting target for our military, for instance, should be 18 to 20-year-old young boys. And that dates from an era in which you won wars by throwing more bodies at the enemy. It's not particularly appropriately matched for an era in which the conflicts are things like cyber conflicts, in which we're worried about things like economic interdependency and economic attacks and so forth. And if we were really reimagining our military, I think we would start from, okay, here's the range of threats that increasingly preoccupy our senior military leaders. who are the people, what are the things that we need, how would we need to retool everything from recruiting to military training and education to the acquisition system to take seriously those threats, not to continue to act on this fantasy that the big threat that's coming is going to be one where we can just throw a lot of bodies at it.
Drones, technology, cyber warfare. Are we even remotely prepared for what is coming? And did Obama, you know, move the needle in terms of that preparation?
I think he moved the needle both in good ways and in bad ways. You know, I think that we're certainly more prepared than we were 10 years ago to deal with other states using those kinds of technologies against us. I think that the military, internal to the military, not so much coming from the political branches, but just the internal discussions within the military, have very much been focused on what many in the military term gray zone conflicts, things that don't look like traditional wars with tanks and planes and lots of infantrymen, but that don't exactly look like peace either, that sort of contested area where the issues may be cyber, it may be fake news and influence operations, it may be other kinds of operations that, again, it involve assassinations, involve attempts to coerce and sow fear, but not at the level we traditionally think of as war. And the military is absolutely trying to think about those things. I think that the difficulty is that the structure and nature of the military and the structure and nature of the congressional budget process and authorization process makes it very hard to make radical changes. Everybody moves on from whatever position they're in after a couple of years, and there's no money and no glory for congressional leaders in thinking about retooling military personnel system as opposed to thinking about spending billions of dollars on a munitions plant in their district.
Does the appointment of Rudy Giuliani to be Donald Trump's cybersecurity chief reassure you that there's
going to be? No, it does not. It really does not. I mean, Rudy Giuliani is not a cyber expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I think the thing that really worries me moving forward in a Trump administration, I said a second ago that Obama had retooled things both in some good ways and some bad ways. The bad thing that I think has happened is that the Bush administration sort of pioneered a bunch of legal arguments that paved the way for really unconstrained executive branch use of coercion and lethal force. Drone strikes are the obvious example, though they're not the only one, that we essentially, the Bush administration created legal justifications for saying, hey, gee whiz, the terrorist threat's always changing. It goes from place to place. And the evidence about it comes from the intelligence community, so it's secret stuff, which means that we need the authority to detain and maybe to kill people anywhere based on evidence that will be secret, and it will be, the decisions will be made in a secret process by people we won't identify, and we're not even going to acknowledge after we detain people or kill them that we did it. And the Obama administration ended up, to a significant extent, embracing and extending those doctrines. Everybody during the Bush administration, including Obama himself, had said, oh, this is terrible, we need to roll it back. But I think what happened is he got into office, found that these were, in fact, kind of convenient to have this ability to act without a lot of scrutiny and without a lot of legal constraint. And to the extent that people raised rule of law concerns about it, he sort of said, you know, I'm a good guy. We're good guys. We're going to use these powers responsibly. And I think by and large they did. And they didn't take seriously the possibility that somebody might come along, the next guy in the White House, the next set of guys, and they wouldn't take those responsibilities as seriously. So that's what really frightens me, is that we're now in a situation where the executive branch has two in a row, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, asserted these very broad, very unconstrained powers with virtually no judicial review, and they're all in the covert realm. And now they're handing those open-ended powers to Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani.
What about within the military culture? Is the ending of Don't Ask, Don't Tell an outlier, or has there been a broad rethinking of military culture in terms of the relation of men and women in service, as well as Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Yeah, I think that's likely to be enduring. I think that after 15 years of conflicts in which women have, whether in a planned way or not, you know, they've been at the pointy end of the spear and they've been the ones just as likely to get blown up by the IEDs as the men. I think we have so much experience of men and women working side by side with just no issues. as well as, you know, just a huge cultural sea change in terms of attitudes towards gays and lesbians. One of the things, I was at the Pentagon during the period in which ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell was being debated, and one of the things that was just most striking to me, there would be things that would be on the news, and you'd walk around the corridors of the Pentagon, everybody would be talking about it, and everybody would be arguing about it. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell wasn't one of those things. It was just a huge non-issue, I think, for most men and women in uniform. Just their reaction was just, yeah, what's the big deal? Who cares? You know, so I doubt that that is likely to change, because I do think that that's a reflection of just a broader cultural shift that most Americans don't see the issue, and the same is true for most military personnel.
The profile of special operations forces has certainly increased since 9/11. If you look at the Obama legacy, what impact has that had on each of the branches of the service?
You know, I think that we've seen a shift in the last few years away from the kind of traditional power bases in the Army and the Marine Corps, and towards both special operations, but also a shift towards the more high-tech capabilities of the Air Force and the Navy. And that sort of very much tracks the Obama administration's determination, which probably will be echoed by Donald Trump's views and policies against large-scale land conflicts, towards more, well, can't we just solve every problem through a combination of surveillance, drone strikes, and the occasional special operations raid? If we really need to have people go somewhere, it will be a small group, in and out, end of story. The interesting question, obviously, are we likely incoming Secretary of Defense, retired Marine Corps General James Mattis, obviously himself as a Marine who has a very deep appreciation of the role of the land forces and the role of the infantry, whether that will shift in any way. But certainly the campaign rhetoric of Donald Trump tended to be leaning much more towards, we're going to use drone strikes, we're going to use air power, we're going to use surveillance if we have to, but I'm not going to get you into any of those big, nasty wars that the American people hate.
Rosa Brooks, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University and author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Back in 2010, a young intelligence analyst in Iraq named Bradley Manning leaked 251,287 U.S. diplomatic cables and 482,832 Army reports, as well as videos of a number of airstrikes, a treasure trove of documents released to WikiLeaks that made the site a 21st century enemy of the state. Bradley Manning, who changed her name to Chelsea Manning as part of her gender transition, was sentenced to 35 years in prison for that act in 2013, the longest sentence ever imposed for disclosing government secrets. But yesterday, she, along with 209 others, were scheduled to be set free by the Obama administration. Here's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest speaking at the White House daily press briefing this past Friday, drawing the line between the actions of Manning and what he says is a more serious active undermining of U.S. national security accomplished, he says, by Edward Snowden, now in exile in Moscow.
Chelsea Manning is somebody who went through the military criminal justice process, was exposed to due process, was found guilty, was sentenced for her crimes, and she acknowledged wrongdoing. Mr. Snowden fled into the arms of an adversary and has sought refuge in a country that most recently made a concerted effort to undermine confidence in our democracy.
Mark Osler is a former federal prosecutor, now a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, where he runs the country's first law school clinic for commutations. Mark, it appears to be that President Obama sees Manning as a conscientious objector case run amok in some personal emotional turmoil, whereas Snowden is seen as a cyber foot soldier, not a civil libertarian in any sense. Is that an accurate characterization?
Yes, it is. And it's surprising because what we just heard from Josh Earnest is very unusual in the field of clemency. It's an opaque process. There's no explanation given generally for why there is a grant made or why a case is denied. As a lawyer, it can be really frustrating because you don't know what the razor of decision was. And so here we got some insight, and it tells us that one of the things they care about is that Manning took responsibility and has served time. And that doesn't just distinguish Manning from Snowden. It distinguishes Manning from Mark Rich. And I think that is a name that is still echoing around the White House.
Remind us of the Mark Rich case back from the Clinton era.
Yes. And in the last days of the Clinton administration, he received a pardon. He had fled to Switzerland and had never admitted his crimes or agreed to extradition to face the charges. And, you know, Eric Holder was involved. It was really something that cast the Clinton administration in a bad light right at the very end. And so I think what we hear Josh Earnest saying is this is no Mark Rich.
And it is the case that the power of the pardon would extend to any, even most of the egregious criminal, and there's nothing that anyone can do about it?
That's correct. And it's been that way from the very start, since George Washington pardoned people who were facing execution in the wake of the Whiskey Rebellion, some of the rebels.
But I guess what is important for lawyers and might be important for someone like you is the difference between certain kinds of treasonous acts in this sort of gray area of cyber leaking, where you can send information and secrets that may have some value as informing the public, a quasi-journalistic function. There's really not going to be any insight as to whether we know more about what's justifiable or less justifiable.
No, it doesn't give us guidance in that. And I think what Earnest was predicting there in what he said was that there's going to be criticism that by giving a commutation to Manning, it won't deter people who are thinking about doing a similar thing. And Earnest emphasized that Manning has done prison time, that has been in prison in the brig since July of 2010. And so there has been significant punishment that's been extracted from that person. And that's distinct from someone else who received an actual pardon yesterday as opposed to a commutation, and that's James Cartwright, the general.
One more thing on Snowden. If Snowden were to come in from the cold and agree to be prosecuted and was convicted at trial, he then could be pardoned and he would, technically speaking, satisfy the same criteria that Chelsea Manning satisfies here.
Yeah, potentially. Of course, that would they would only be equivalent in that sense after he'd served several years, and we don't have that.
Has there ever been a case where a president has pardoned someone who is an active fugitive?
Well, Mark Rich. And that's right.
Mark Rich was on the lam when he was pardoned.
He was on the lam, and that's what made it such a stunning decision by President Clinton.
So Clinton is the only one who's ever pardoned anyone who's a fugitive?
I can't say that definitively. I haven't studied that question. But within the modern era, within my lifetime and memory, yes, that's the only one. And one of the things, too, about this is I wish that this drama had been spread out over 8 years. It would have been much more efficient to have done it that way, or to have had a targeted program that was outside of the Department of Justice, like what President Ford did for draft evaders back in the 70s. But even coming at the end here, one of the things that it really brings to the surface is that in this country, we can care an awful lot about the liberty of one person. With everything going on, the inauguration, the nominees being vetted, all the discussion that goes with the repeal of Obamacare, what we're thinking about and talking about is Chelsea Manning. I was a federal prosecutor, and so I put people in prison, and a lot of them, I feel very good that they went to prison. But now, with clemency, I get to do something that's really remarkable, and that is, and this is something I hope I get to do in the next couple of days, again, is call someone in prison, someone perhaps who's doing a life sentence, who is over-sentenced, and tell them they're going to go home. That's an incredible moment.
Mark Osler is a former federal prosecutor, now a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, where he runs this nation's first law school clinic for commutations. Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
If I don't have a pardon, I'm facing deportation.
Ravi Raghbir wasn't one of the 64 people pardoned by President Obama on Tuesday. Ravi immigrated from Trinidad and Tobago in 1991. He became a legal permanent resident, but 15 years ago, he was convicted of fraud. Ravi served his time, but then found out that this single conviction was grounds for mandatory deportation.
There's a high possibility that I will be picked up and I will be deported. So that affects not only myself, but my family, my wife, my daughter.
Ravi has been an immigrant rights activist in New York City since his release from prison. He has a wife and daughter who are American citizens. Lawyer Alina Das A law professor at New York University says Ravi is the perfect candidate for a pardon. And Olina and Ravi say they're holding out hope with the little time that is left.
Ravi really exemplifies exactly what the pardon process is for, people who have used their time after a conviction to do good work, to be with their family. Ravi's helped countless immigrants go through the system and achieve something that he has been yet to achieve, which is an ability to stay here with his family. But unfortunately, there has been a bureaucracy and a backlog in these cases. Obviously, the Justice Department is trying to go through them carefully, but there are approximately 2,000 people like Ravi who are just waiting for their pardon application to be considered.
And there's an active deportation order in your case?
Yes, there is an active deportation order. I've had this for a few years now, but my attorneys, as Alina said, they have been trying to overturn this many, many years. Even though I have this criminal conviction, and it does mean that there's mandatory deportation, which itself means that you don't have any argument, any way to bring discretion and to bring the community that you are part of.
Certainly, pardon is something that's completely up to the discretion of the president.
Right.
And as you may have noticed, the president has had a real tough time getting his program and his vision, particularly on immigration reform, through Congress. How do you think pardoning you would reflect his vision of what he thinks should happen in the United States?
Well, you just hit the nail on his head. He had a vision. He has a vision of helping immigrants, and he tried to push that through Congress. If he pardons myself, it would put us back in a good position. It would mean that the terror that we face, the terror that I face, and my wife face, will not be there. We can live a life in dignity.
If there's no pardon?
If there's no pardon, I continue to live one day at a time. Right now, I cannot plan anything further than 2 weeks ahead because I don't know what will happen. If you tell me, let's have a dinner in June, I will say, yes, I'll appreciate that, but get back to me closer to that time. That terror that I face is very tangible. And, after the election, my wife, who is an immigration advocate also, an immigration attorney, she did not stop crying for 24 hours because she understood the impact it would have on me and the impact it will have on our lives.
Alina, as a lawyer, does it feel like due process or does it feel more like applying to Harvard or something?
Well, President Obama himself recently described the pardon process as a lottery. So when you hear something like mm-hmm. that, I mean, there's an acknowledgement. And I do think that the people within the pardon attorney's office have been trying to move mountains to get through the paperwork. But a lot of these changes are coming very late in the game. And to describe something that is so consequential, like the difference between Ravi being able to hopefully be able to be in the U.S. to walk his daughter down the aisle one day when she gets married, to grow old with his wife and to retire, all of those things, to continue his work every day on behalf of immigrants. I mean, all of those things, that turning on something that the president himself has described as a lottery, that doesn't feel like due process. And I hope that we'll see reform in the system as other presidents take this on.
Ravi and Alina, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Ravi Raghbir is an immigration rights activist in New York. His lawyer is a law professor who co-directs the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at New York University.
I support accountability.
Okay, is that a yes or a no?
I support accountability.
Do you not want to answer my question?
You can't say definitively today that guns shouldn't be in schools?
Mrs. DeVos, have you ever taken out a student loan?
I have not.
But it surprises me that you don't know this issue.
If confirmed, I will certainly be very vigilant.
Yeah, I'm asking
people
how.
Did Education Secretary nominee Betsy DeVos pass her oral exam in what turned out to be a contentious partisan confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill this week? It's unclear if any awkward moments will slow down these nominees in what's been a festival of confirmation hearings, though. Tom Price for Secretary of Health and Human Services will be overseeing the Obamacare repeal. He's on the Hill. Nikki Haley for UN Ambassador, Scott Pruitt for Administrator of the EPA, and Commerce Secretary nominee Wilbur Ross, all in hearings today as well. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. It's Tom Price who may be in the most delicate situation right now, yes?
That's probably true. And there's two big things happening behind Tom Price amid all of these nominations happening all at once that you mentioned, John. One, of course, is the Obamacare repeal, how fast that will happen and what replacement will look like should Tom Price be the guy who oversees it for Donald Trump when he heads up HHS. There are many, many questions behind that because the White House hasn't released a policy yet, the incoming White House. Donald Trump has said lots of things about what he intends health insurance to look like. Nobody on Capitol Hill knows where to hang their hat on any of that stuff. But more immediately, John, some ethical issues around Tom Price, about some stock buys that he made, not only while a congressman, but while a congressman who was introducing health care legislation in some cases that affected individual companies that were at stake on the Hill. Here's Tom Price first reacting to some Democratic allegations that some of his stock trades might not have been ethically permissible.
Everything that we have done has been above board, transparent, ethical, and legal.
But they're talking about whether he's actually the secretary of hip replacements, right?
Yeah, so a couple of stock trades are at stake here. One is a company called Zimmer Biomedtrics. It makes joint replacements. Tom Price bought a couple of thousands of dollars of that stock and then a week later introduced legislation that would have actually slowed down regulation of that very company. Democrats are raising that up. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, suggested that trade may have been illegal and he wants it investigated before Price's nomination can go forward. Another is a company called Innate Immunotherapeutics. They're an Australian company. They make an MS drug, multiple sclerosis. There's another congressman who's the major shareholder of that company and who's on the board. Tom Price got a stock tip about that company, then bought some of the stock in a private stock buy, not available to the general stock exchange, but to a few people, including a couple of lobbyists and a couple of congressmen. And Democrats are shining some light on that as well, John, before they even get to the issues of what health care will look like for millions of Americans once Obamacare is repealed.
Do we know where Tom Price stands on what should replace Obamacare, at least on that basis?
Well, Tom Price himself has introduced major health care legislation as chairman of the Budget Committee and as a guy who's been arguing on health care with Democrats and with Republicans, frankly, for many, many years. Tom Price has a plan, but there's no indication that the Tom Price plan, which is a bunch of tax credits for people, giving states more power to regulate their own insurance industries, letting people buy insurance across state lines, that Donald Trump would sponsor any of those things. And again, there is no indication of what the Trump plan is going to look like that Republicans are going to be asked to vote on. You want to hear Bernie Sanders talking to Tom Price about what health care is going to look like. Here's Bernie Sanders.
In Canada, in other countries, all people have the right to get health care. Do you believe we should move in that direction?
If you want to talk about other countries' health care systems, there are consequences to the decisions that they've made, just as there are consequences to the decision that we've made. I believe and I look forward to working with you to make certain that every single American has access to the highest quality care and coverage that is possible.
Nice dodge there.
Has access to does not mean that they are guaranteed health care. I have access to buying a $10 million home. I don't have the money to do that.
He's good. Well, all right, that's Tom Price. So let's spin the wheel here. You want to take a shot at Nikki Haley, UN Ambassador Scott Pruitt, Administrator of the EPA, or Commerce Secretary nominee Wilbur Ross?
Let's talk about Scott Pruitt real quick, who's in front of the Environment Committee today. He's the controversial choice of Donald Trump, controversial to many environmental groups because of some of the positions that he's taken, not only on climate change, but really on the federal government's right or power, I should say, to regulate environmental issues or whether it should be left to the states. Scott Pruitt is the Attorney General of Oklahoma, and he's filed a whole bunch of lawsuits against the EPA, questioning their ability to regulate everything from mercury to carbon, clean air standards, and a lot of other things. So what you're hearing is Democrats really, you know, with their environmental supporters behind them taking shots at Scott Pruitt. There haven't been any Republicans who've suggested they aren't for him, even though there's been some tepid support, John. So I think you could expect Scott Pruitt to probably enjoy confirmation before too long.
But just in policy terms, it's fairly clear that Pruitt opposes the EPA regulating carbon as a, you know, toxic environmental pollutant.
I think that that's clear. The Supreme Court has ruled that the EPA has a mandate to regulate carbon. That's a Supreme Court ruling. They have to regulate it. The question is how. Now, Scott Pruitt did tell senators that he does think that for interstate pollutants, for an issue where, let's say, you know, a pollutant upstream flows downstream and affects another state, that the EPA has a critical role there. But his view of the EPA's broader role in regulating environmental toxins, clean air, clean water, is much, much more restrictive than any of the Democrats and even some of the Republicans who questioned him today. In the end, though, it seems unlikely to keep him out of the EPA, John, an organization and an agency that he has criticized and fought in court more than a dozen times during his career.
And he will probably be at the helm of it as a result. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Because of you, I know that my race does not define who I am or what I can accomplish.
On the Jimmy Fallon show last week, I don't know if you saw this, it's on YouTube, but there was a demonstration in Michelle Obama's signature Oh Shucks Best Girlfriend way that showed the raw power of this first lady who compares to no other.
Thank you for making me a more confident woman.
Speaking deep from the heart, that is the one value I try to teach my kids.
People start giving testimonies to a first lady photo, then from behind a curtain in the flesh, Michelle Obama steps forward, causing the fans to collapse in gobs of tears and shrieks.
Wow.
Oh. Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you so much.
Approval rating doesn't really describe the emotional connection many Americans have developed with Michelle Obama. It's a connection with people around the world that will certainly survive the Obama presidency. An artifact of that emotional geology can be found in a book from author Veronica Chambers, original essays from people like filmmaker Ava DuVernay, chef Marcus Samuelson, essayist for WNYC Rebecca Carroll, The Meaning of Michelle, 16 writers on the iconic First Lady and how her journey inspires our own.
That thing that Michelle Obama has been able to do, where she has been able to be strong and respectable and smart and impressive, and yet still do mom dancing with Jimmy Fallon and carpool karaoke. I mean, especially as a black woman, as a woman of color, I don't think we've seen that kind of range. You know, it puts a lot of old stereotypes on their head, and it just represents a wide scope of how to be and a wide scope of possibility.
How much envy is there in this book of just really aspiring to either have what she has or think the way she thinks or really to go on the same journey that she's gone on?
You know, it's funny because I think that she doesn't invoke envy in the way that someone else might, partly because she wears it all so easily. And I also think one of the things that the book and the people in the book do is that they really, you know, demarcate in their writing that it's been a journey. She's been on an evolution. And you can see it in her style. You can see it in the causes she's chosen, from the garden to Let's Move to Let Girls Learn. Tiffany Dufu, who has a book coming out called Drop the Ball, she had an interview with Michelle Obama, and she asked her about advice for her daughter, and she says, I just encourage her to breathe, to lower the perfection bar. Just live your life and figure out what's in your heart. What you need will change every year, and you've got to be okay with that. And that alone, that's not just advice for Malia. That's advice for women everywhere. And so that's been one of the gifts, is that we got to see her do it. We got to see her figure it out piece by piece. And she did it with so much grace. It gave us a confidence that we could do some of that in our own lives, too.
And Tiffany Dufu's essay is entitled On Being Flawlessly Imperfect.
Yes.
It sort of says it all right there. Why do you think it was her who referenced that she lives in a home that was built by slave labor, and she has that garden that it seems to be so filled with meaning on so many levels other than just, you know, great food at the table?
You know, I think that that's where you go to the authenticity. A lot of other women in a similar circumstance walking into the White House with this culture and heritage wouldn't want to point to slavery. You know, slave culture has been sort of submerged because somehow it comes across as shameful. And yet, you know, I remember being one of handful of Black students on a really predominantly white campus and feeling really isolated. And there were days when I wanted to drop out, when things were said to me, when too many people were touching my hair, and when I felt like my teachers weren't getting me. And I remember sitting in a library and thinking, if Henry Box Brown could mail himself to freedom, I can get through college. And so, you know, slavery is not a shameful legacy. The legacy of the shame in slavery is really in the slaveholder. And yet it's a very difficult legacy. It has been and continues to be a difficult legacy for us to claim with any pride because obviously of all the, you know, murkiness and violence and the way that it's a foundation of our country.
8 years seems like an eye blink now that it's almost over. But do you think she was happy during much of that time or any of that time?
I think so. I think that when you look at things like the White House Poetry Jam or Hamilton, you know, for when we first got our glimpse of Hamilton, the way that she opened that home up and, you know, Jason Moran and Alicia Hall Moran talk about this in their essay and they say, you know, for all the eyes that were on her, the amazing, beautiful, powerful thing she did was that she reversed the gaze. She didn't say, it's all about me and my home and my dress and my children, my husband and the state dinner. She just threw the doors open and she put the emphasis, the gaze on children, on artists, on writers, on what she did for visual artists in that home, what she did for the elderly, for the sick. I mean, I remember her dancing with that woman who was like 102 years old. I'll never forget that. You know, she was constantly reversing the gaze, and I think she took great pleasure in that, among many other things.
So you're young, but what if 20, 25 years from now you run into Michelle Obama? What would you want to tell her about what it was that was iconic about her that you've sort of kept close to your own heart in your own life?
You know, it's funny because people keep going, well, you've met her. I haven't met her.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I didn't have to meet her to just know that someone who looks like me, who had a similar skin tone, who had, you know, the similar cultural features and heritage, held this role with so much grace and so much style, and she lived the questions out loud. And, you know, Brené Brown has a phrase where she says, you know, if I get to be like me, I belong. If I have to be like you, I fit in. And I feel like the greatest lesson for me and my daughter is that I learned the difference between belonging and fitting in, and I don't think I can ever go back to the idea that I have to be more like what is considered mainstream to be acceptable. And that's a huge gift.
And Michelle teaches that lesson to you and to other young women?
I think absolutely. I mean, I you know, when you are a first and only, it's really hard to figure out how much of yourself you get to be in the room. And I think that seeing what Michelle Obama did with this role, it gave me a sense of how to belong by being yourself. That is both a gift for myself and for my daughter. You know, my daughter who has big, frizzy afro, she said to me the other day, I was combing her hair and putting it, and she goes, you know, just so you know, I have no problem having kinky hair, and I'll just wear it out in an afro. You don't have to pull it back into a nice bun. And I thought, okay, you know, that's a little thing, but it only comes when you see your own beauty modeled around you in ways big and small.
Talking with Veronica Chambers, who's a writer and author of The Meaning of Michelle, 16 writers writing about the iconic First Lady and how her journey inspires our own. She's a JSK fellow at Stanford University, where I'm speaking to her from. Veronica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Judy from Central Virginia. I will remember her with great fondness and with the hope to someday meet her and bask in the glow of her intelligence and grace and warmth. As a role model for women and especially women of color, her shadow will reach across our country and around the world. Looking forward to whatever is next for her.
How do you remember Michelle Obama's legacy? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to hear your sense of her meaning. You can go to the Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.